This is Shabby, and coming up next on Spock's Talk is the Toig Effect.
Welcome to the Toig Effect. This is your host, Toig. Today we discuss two American icons. Today we look back at two of America's most stalwart patriots and staunchest critics. Today we revisit the life and times of Woody and Arlo Guthrie, true American patriots. According to Woody Guthrie's own biography at woodyguthrie.org, Woodrow Wilson Guthrie was born on July 14, 1912, in Okemah, Oklahoma. Describing the small frontier town in Okfuskee County, Woody writes, "Okemah was one of the singiest, square dancingest, drinkingest, yellingest, preachingest, walkingest, talkingest, laughingest, cryingest, shootingest, fist-fightingest, bleedingest, gamblingest gun club and razor carryingest of our ranch towns and farm towns, because it blossomed out into one of our first oil boom towns." Woody was the second born son to Charles and Nora Bell Guthrie. His father was a cowboy, land speculator, and local politician. His Kansas-born mother profoundly influenced Woody in ways which would become apparent as he grew older. Slightly built, with an extremely full and curly head of hair, Woody was both a precocious and unconventional boy from the start. A keen observer of the world around him during his early years in Oklahoma, Woody experienced the first in a series of tragic personal losses. The death of his older sister, Clara, would haunt him throughout his life. This, followed by the financial and physical ruin and the institutionalization of his mother, would devastate Woody's family and home, forming a uniquely wry and rambling outlook on life. Woody became part of the Great Migration out west, the one that would be later called the Dust Bowl, which saw countless millions migrate to Washington, Oregon, and California. These people would later become known as Okies, and those who joined them from Arkansas would become Arkies. These people would forever be immortalized in the John Ford movie, Grapes of Wrath, written by a local Californian, John Steinbeck, but discussing the sudden migration of countless thousands of farmers and farm workers to the Salinas Valley in California's Golden Coast. By the time he arrived in California in 1937, Woody had experienced the intense scorn, hatred, and antagonism of resident Californians who were opposed to the influx of outsiders. Woody's identification with outsider status would become part and parcel of his political and social positioning, one which gradually worked its way into his songwriting, as evident in his Dust Bowl ballads such as "I Ain't Got No Home," "Going Down the Road Feeling Bad," "Talking Dust Bowl Blues," and "Tom Joad and Hard Traveling." His 1937 radio broadcasts on KFVD Los Angeles and XELO in Tijuana, Mexico, brought Woody and his new singing partner, Maxine Chrisman, or Lefty Lou, wide public attention, while providing him with a forum from which he could develop his talent for controversial social commentary and criticism on topics ranging from corrupt politicians, lawyers, and businessmen, to praising the humanist principles of Jesus Christ, Pretty Boy Floyd, and union organizers. But Woody wasn't satisfied with his newfound fame in Los Angeles. He traveled to New York City, where he was immediately embraced by the leftist entertainment community of the day. Lead Belly, Cisco Houston, Burl Ives, Pete Seeger, Will Gear, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee, Josh White, Millard Lample, Bess Hawes, Sis Cunningham, among others, became Woody's friends and collaborators, taking up such social causes as union organizing, anti-fascism, strengthening the Communist Party, and generally fighting for the things they believed in the only way they knew how, through political songs of protest. And Woody wasn't satisfied with his New York contemporaries either. After only a few years, he set off south in search of his true calling. He soon received an invitation to Oregon, where a documentary film project about the building of the Grand Coulee Dam sought to use his songwriting talents. The Bonneville Power Authority placed Woody on the federal payroll for a month, and there he composed yet another remarkable collection of songs, the Columbia River Songs, which include Roll on Columbia and Grand Coulee Dam. Around the same time, he joined Pete Seeger in the legendary folk protest group Almanac Singers, with whom he toured the country and moved into the Cooperative Almanac House in Greenwich Village. Guthrie originally wrote and sang anti-war songs with the Almanac Singers, but after America's entry into World War II, he began writing anti-fascist tunes. Guthrie famously wrote the slogan, "This machine kills fascists," on his guitar. Woody was a devout anti-fascist and served several tours of duty in World War II. Woody served in both the Merchant Marine and the Army, shipping out to sea on several occasions with his buddies Cisco Houston and Jimmy Lungi. In one of many anti-fascist songs written during the war, Woody tells us, "We were seamen three, Cisco, Jimmy, and me, shipped out to beat the fascists across the land and sea." In 1940, Woody penned, "This Land Is Your Land," a takeoff on the Baptist hymn, "When the World's on Fire," recorded by the Carter family 10 years before. Nevertheless, the song became almost an instant traditional ballad that Woody wrote specifically to replace the song "God Bless America," a song Woody felt was undeserving of the high praise given it by others. Woody was very patriotic and always sought to address the true concerns of this country. He would take whatever step, walk whatever mile, ride whatever link in order to get his point across. In 1967, Pete Seeger wrote of Woody during this time frame, "When Woody Guthrie was singing hillbilly songs on a little Los Angeles radio station in the late 1930s, he used to mail out a small mimeographed songbook to listeners who wanted the words to his songs. On the bottom of one page appeared the following, quote, 'This song is copyrighted in the U.S. under seal of copyright number 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anybody caught singing it without our permission will be mighty good friends, Aaron, because we don't give it earned. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it. We wrote it, that's all we wanted to do it. Fortunately, we can still find commentary by the Library of Congress back in 1941. Several letters reflect Guthrie's communist ideals and his sensitivity to the condition of the working class and the problems of corruption. For example, in his letter of February 15, 1941, Guthrie wrote, 'Folks are just plain folks everywhere you go. All has been hit hard. Went through several political cyclones. Been sold out so often that they feel like they've got pimps.' In another letter, called Vote for Bloat, he remarks on problems with elections in the United States. 'The average elections are about as useful as a slop jar without a bottom in it. Down in Baltimore, Maryland, they won't let you buy no liquor on election day, and so they sell more than ever on that day. They say they want you to vote sober. What difference does it make? You couldn't vote no wronger. Sometimes I think you ought to try it the other way. If the people was to ever win an election, they'd think they was dead and in heaven. I mean in heaven without having to die. Some states charge you $1.75 to vote. They call it poll tax. That takes a week's groceries and snuff. And most folks figure that Democrats ain't worth $1.75 and the Republicans ain't worth that much." Woody could have been describing the 2006 elections for what it's worth. He was a patriot before his time, a true balladeer of American folklore, who lived the hard rural life and who sang praises about it. This is also part of my upbringing, so I feel a kinship. I must say that it is also the life of many people around the world, all of whom could share in his music. Of course, being a child of the 60s, I can't leave this message without a discussion of just Woody Guthrie. It would be like discussing one side of the coin. By the time I heard of the person, Woody Guthrie, as opposed to the song by Woody Guthrie, "This Land Is Your Land," I had already heard of his son, Arlo Guthrie. For those who lived during the late 60s, there is no mistaking two great phenoms during those years, Yellow Submarine and Alice's Restaurant. Unbeknownst to us hippies, we were being given the teachings of Woody through his son Arlo. All of the absurdities of government were well exposed. Arlo's exposure of a blind judge to proceed over his case after the prosecution put into evidence 27 pictures is hilarious. Arlo Guthrie was born with a guitar in one hand and a harmonica in the other in Coney Island, Brooklyn, New York in 1947. He is the eldest son of America's most beloved singer, writer, philosopher, Woody Guthrie, and Marjorie Mazet Guthrie. Arlo Guthrie's career exploded in 1967 with the release of Alice's Restaurant, whose title song premiered at the Newport Folk Festival helped foster a new commitment against the 60s generation to social consciousness and activism. Arlo went on to star in the 1969 Hollywood film version of Alice's Restaurant, directed by Arthur Penn. Here, in this excerpt from Alice's Restaurant, we hear about the absurdity of American justice on all levels. The scene is Stockbridge, Massachusetts, the day after Thanksgiving, 1965. Arlo and his friend Ray were accused of dumping garbage on the side of the road. As he stated earlier in the song, "We came to a side of a road, and off the side of the road was another 15-foot cliff. And at the bottom of the cliff was another pile of garbage. And we decided that one big pile was better than two little piles. And rather than bring that one up, we decided to throw ours down. That's what we did." This event triggered a response by the local police that became so tragically comical as to render the entire judicial proceedings a farce. In Arlo's own words, "We drove back to the church, had a Thanksgiving dinner that couldn't be beat, went to sleep, and didn't get up until the next morning when we got a phone call from Officer Obie. He said, 'Kid, we found your name on an envelope at the bottom of half a ton of garbage, and I just wanted to know if you had any information about it.' And I said, 'Yes, sir, Officer Obie, I cannot tell a lie. I put that envelope under that garbage.' After speaking to Obie for about 45 minutes on the telephone, we finally arrived at the truth of the matter, and he said that we had to go down and pick up the garbage, and also had to go down and speak to him at the police officer station. I want to tell you about the town of Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where this is happening. They got 3 stop signs, 2 police officers, and 1 police car, but when we got to the scene of the crime, there was 5 police officers and 3 police cars, being the biggest crime of the last 50 years, and everybody wanted to get in the newspaper story about it. And they was using up all kinds of cop equipment that they had hanging around the police officer station. They was taking plaster tire track footprints, dog smelling prints, and they took 27 8x10 color glossy photographs with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was about to be used as evidence against us. Took pictures of the approach, the getaway, the northwest corner, the southwest corner. When we all had to go to court, we walked in, sat down. Obie came in with 27 8x10 color glossy pictures with circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one. Sat down. Man came in and said, 'All rise.' We all stood up, and Obie stood up with the 27 8x10 color glossy pictures, and the judge walked in, sat down with the C&I dog, and he sat down. We sat down. Obie looked at the C&I dog. Then at the 27 8x10 color glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and looked at the C&I dog. And then at the 27 8x10 color glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and a paragraph on the back of each one, and began to cry, because Opie came to the realization that it was a typical case of American blind justice, and there wasn't nothing he could do about it, and the judge wasn't going to look at the 27 8x10 color glossy pictures with the circles and arrows and the paragraph on the back of each one explaining what each one was to be used as evidence against us. And we was fined $50 and had to pick up the garbage in the snow. But that's not what I'm here to tell you about. I'm here to talk about the draft." And with that segue, Arlo took us all from a comical story about rural police activity to something much more sinister and menacing, the draft. When Alice's Restaurant came out, the draft was still in full force. Everyone had to register and serve. Obviously, those who could pay for deferments did so. Those whose family connections were high enough or specific enough were allowed to skate. But it wasn't until 1971, when the United States Supreme Court decision broadened U.S. rules beyond religious beliefs as grounds for conscientious objection. In Arlo's day, either you were wealthy or you served. Thus, his next tirade about being inducted into the Army was one born of desperation and fear. Arlo was looking for any method of getting out of the draft. Here's his story on it. "I went down and got my physical examination one day, and I walked in, sat down, got good and drunk the night before, so I looked and felt my best when I went in that morning, because I wanted to look like the all-American kid from New York City. I wanted to be the all-American kid from New York City. And I walked in, sat down, I was hung down, brung down, hung up, and all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. And I walked in, I sat down, they gave me a piece of paper that said, 'Kid, see the psychiatrist in room 604. I went up there. I said, "Shrink, I want to kill. I want to kill. I want to see blood and gore and guts and veins in my teeth. Eat dead, burnt bodies. I mean, kill. Kill.' And I started jumping up and down yelling, 'Kill. Kill.' And he started jumping up and down with me, and we was both jumping up and down yelling, "Kill, kill, kill." And the sergeant came over, pinned the middle on me, sent me down the hall, said, "You're our boy." Didn't feel too good about it. Alice's Restaurant was an instant anthem for all of us in the 60s. It exposed the stupidities of local police activity as well as the absurdities of our military. When the movie came out, it only reinforced our understanding that what Arlo was lamenting was indeed the reality we faced in America in the late 1960s. The war in Vietnam was destroying us from within, and we were being told that we were either anti-communist or anti-American. Everywhere there were bumper stickers proudly proclaiming, "America, love it or leave it." Much like in today's America, we were given a black or white scenario whereby we were supposed to either blindly follow our leadership regardless of the path chosen, or we were to renounce our heritage. Dissent was not an option. Alice's Restaurant and other great songs by Arlo showed us the idiocy of such thinking and the absurdity of its manifestations. Both Woody and Arlo Guthrie have given America much to be thankful for. They have woven into songs and film what many of us feel in our heart. They have given modern America a rare but true picture of itself, and they have done so in a way that allows us to acknowledge our errant ways in a peaceful, perhaps even humorous way. From Woody's staunch anti-fascist stance to Arlo's anti-war stance, they have both become icons in our country and will forever be associated with the ideals and principles first penned by our founding fathers over 200 years ago. They have become two of our greatest beacons of the American way of life. For the Toig Effect, this is Toig.